everyone. Buenos días a todos y a todas. Bienvenidos. Esta sesión va a ser conducida en inglés, pero si necesitan traducción, hay traducción en esta sesión. Welcome, everyone. The session will be conducted in English, but there is interpretation available into Spanish. My name is Zoni Woods, and I am here on behalf of the Leadership Committee of the conference, and I am also working with the HIV initiative at the Ford Foundation, and it gives me great pleasure to welcome all of you to this session. This session is entitled Women's Rights Equal Women's Lives. And we are very fortunate to have some incredible panelists today that have been at the forefront of ensuring that violence against women is addressed at the global level, at the regional level, at the national level, and in their communities. I should also clarify that I am not Charlotte Bunch. For those of you who know Charlotte and her incredible work over the last two decades in ensuring that women's human rights are at the center of the human rights agenda, she unfortunately could not be here with us today, but I know that she is here with us in spirit. I also have apologies from Tsebile Nobu from ICW, who unfortunately cannot be here, as well as Eliana Elias. But as you will see, we have gathered an incredible and very diverse group of women and a strong ally from the men's community. So we're very fortunate to have them here with us today. The format for this session is very simple. We wanted to have a conversation with all of you about this issue. So we will not spend a great deal of time in long presentations. We will make very short presentations. We will have a conversation among the panelists. And then we want to hear from you, both your comments, your questions, your suggestions. And we will have cards available as well. If you do not want to use the microphone, you can also submit questions to us. The order for the day is we will hear first from Charlotte Watts from the UK. She will be followed by Ebony Johnson from the US, Ana Luis Crago from Canada, Claudia Garcia Moreno from Mexico and working and living in Switzerland for WHO, Bafana Kumalo from South Africa, and Patience Mandishona from Zimbabwe. We will start off with Charlotte Watts, who is a professor at the London School of Hygiene. She heads a center of research on gender, violence, and health. And her research has focused on working with WHO on a multi-country study on violence and intervention, research on HIV, violence prevention, mostly in South Africa, Uganda, and Cote d'Ivoire. So please welcome Charlotte Watts.
Good morning. Can everybody hear me? It's a great pleasure to have this opportunity to talk about violence and HIV. I've been asked to try and summarize, well, what are the connections? If you're in the HIV field and this is a new area, well, what are the sort of ways in which violence may increase women's vulnerability to HIV infection? Now, when the organizers asked me to do that, I must admit that I shuddered because I'll show you up on that slide. On the left is all the different forms of violence that women experience. And often in the HIV debate, people focus on sexual violence, on rape. But in practice, there's a whole host of forms of violence that women experience that put them at risk of violence from an early age through to when they're very old. You know, there's child sexual abuse. We have partner and non-partner sexual violence. But we also have other forms of violence by intimate partners, physical violence, psychological abuse, economic abuse, all of which might pose incredible barriers on women being able to protect themselves from HIV. You'll also see very high levels of violence against sex workers and injecting drug users and other vulnerable groups. And we have extremes in violence, such as trafficking of women into sex work, which is a growing global phenomenon and an important issue for HIV. And likewise, just as there are many forms of violence against women, there are also many ways in which violence puts women at risk. There's the most obvious direct issues to do with transmission resulting from a forced sexual occurrence, and within that there's the potential that because of force you might have genital lesions which have the potential to potentially facilitate HIV transmission. And particularly if you think about child rape, it's likely that that could be quite an important factor in terms of, you know, making very high levels of vulnerability. But you also have the broader issues around women who are in violent relationships really having very little control over when they have sex, let alone whether a condom is used. The problems that if you're fearing violence about negotiating condom use, or if your partner is an injecting drug user, potentially negotiating safe injection practices if you also inject. We're also seeing evidence about the impact of early childhood sexual abuse and how disruptive that is, not only in the short term, but also in the long term. We see both men and women who have been sexually abused as a child going on to have a whole host of high-risk behaviors, including high levels of alcohol use, injecting use, sex work, multiple sexual partners. So that the issue of violence is that when it's seeded early on, it can influence a whole life course in terms of risk that's associated with HIV. And clearly also we have the issues around violence in response to HIV, and issues to do with women experiencing violence if they disclose their status, and the way that violence may put up a barrier for women being able to access treatment and care services. So that's the kind of complexity of the issue. What I wanted to do now is just show you some of the data that we have about the links. If you want to look at biological data on the evidence, it's relatively limited. There haven't been many studies that have looked at this, but the studies that have find very compelling results. In South Africa, a study of urban antenatal women found that women with violent partners were 50% more likely to be infected than other women. In Tanzania, the odds of reporting violence are 10 times higher for young HIV-positive women if you compare them with HIV-negative women. A very new study that's come out from Goa in India has found that amongst married women, the risk of incident HIV is 3 times higher for married women whose partners have been sexually violent towards them than compared with other women. And in Rakhine, Uganda, epidemiological work there is showing how girls who've reported coerced or forced early sex have a higher risk in the long term of HIV infection. There isn't much data around the levels of violence associated with disclosure, but a review by WHO found ranges of between 0.4 and 4% in the US and between 3.5 and 14% in sub-Saharan Africa. So although we only have a relatively limited body of evidence that talking very directly about that link, what we do have increasingly is data from very large population surveys about the extent of different forms of violence against women. And so what I'm showing you now are results from a 10-country WHO multi-country study on women's health and domestic violence. And what this slide shows is the percentage of sexually active women who are interviewed in each setting who report that their first sexual experience is forced. So we've ordered the countries from the highest prevalence to the lowest, and you can see that in many settings, it's not just one region, in several regions, we've got very high levels of forced first sex. In five of the sites that we studied, more than 15% of women said that their first sexual experience is forced. You know, clearly that's an important issue for HIV. We might not need the epidemiological evidence to say, well, how does that relate to transmission? If first sex is forced, we need to be taking that on board as part of our prevention strategy. An interesting addition to this slide is that when we look at the age of that first sex, the earlier that first sex occurred, the more likely that first sexual experience was forced. So sexual coercion not only have sexual coercion, but it also means that girls are having sex earlier than they would otherwise. This slide shows from the same study the prevalence of sexual violence against women. And here what we've done is plot in the dark blue bars, the proportion of women reporting being sexually assaulted by somebody other than their partner. And then the dark red bars show the proportion of women reporting being sexually assaulted by their partner. And then the yellow bars show the combination of the two. Again, shocking levels of violence across these very diverse settings. Another common finding that you see here is that although it's very tempting when you think about sexual violence to think about non-partner violence, that the reality is really that majority of sexual violence for women of reproductive age is by their intimate partners. And that's an important challenge that we need to take on board as part of our response to the HIV epidemic. Another thing that's emerging from further analysis of that WHO data and from other studies is the way that we have a clustering of risk behaviours. So there's growing evidence that men who are abusive to their partners also have a number of other risk behaviours that we know are associated with HIV. There are studies showing that they're more likely to have more sexual partners, more likely to have an STI, to potentially have problematic use of alcohol, and to refuse to use a condom. And I think it's these combinations of factors. It's not only that a man is forcing his partner to have sex or she is scared to refuse sex. It's also that that guy is somebody who also is at quite at high risk of HIV that's resulting in those odds ratios that I showed you in the first slide. I don't want to finish this talk and sharing the evidence without talking a little bit about the extent of violence against sex workers, because it's such a common phenomena. This slide shows results from Cambodia on a study that interviewed freelance sex workers about their experiences of violence. And I apologize for the slightly fuzzy figures, but you've got 43% reporting being beaten by a client, 45% saying money's been taken from them, 57% saying they've been raped by a client, and 54% saying that they've been gang raped. What amazes me, we recently tried to do a review of what are the levels of violence against sex workers. And if you think of all the behavioral surveys that have been conducted amongst sex workers, we could only find a handful of studies that actually asked sex workers about how much violence was occurring. And to me, that's a really depressing state of affairs. If we don't even think enough in our surveys about about sex workers and their risk of HIV to ask about violence, how can we then think about, well, what to do in response to that? And particularly when you do ask if you get these sorts of figures. So in conclusion, I think everybody here would agree that violence against women fundamentally undermines our current HIV response. It's something that we have to take seriously as part of our invigorated efforts to address HIV. We have the kind of ABC of HIV prevention. Violence undermines each of these. Coerced sex, how can you abstain if you're coerced to have sex? How can you change behavior if you aren't in control of your sexual behavior? How can you negotiate condom use in a violent relationship? How can we deal with the fear of the repercussions of testing as part of our response? I'll end there. Thank you.
Thank you, Charlotte, for such an important overview of the issue. We'd like to hear from Ebony Johnson, who is with ICW North America. She works with Family Connections, which is a PARD program focused on women living with HIV, and she's currently working on community dialogues with women living with HIV and domestic violence providers to increase linkages, expand support, and ensure safety. Ebony?
Good morning. Gender inequity continues to be at the helm of HIV and domestic violence. The messages that we give to young women are often messages of being chaste, being abstinent, and the messages that go out to young men are often of being wild and being very sexual beings. I think a big part of what lies at the helm of this is the need for comprehensive sexual and reproductive health education that does not start at the onset of sex, but that starts early on in schools, that people are getting healthy messages about being sexual beings, and also that are embedded in respect, that are embedded in quality of life. We need to instill in our young women that they are able to make healthy choices, that they have options. Oftentimes, women get in positions where they become financially dependent upon their partners, where they are not able to make choices around disclosure once they become positive. There's threats of leaving them, there's threats of isolation. So we have to make sure that we have a support network built, not only from within the HIV provider community, but also within domestic violence support. Oftentimes, domestic violence workers have a unique relationship with women that put them in a position to be able to advocate. So we need to make sure that we're reaching out to those domestic violence workers, that they are being trained properly, and that they understand the correlation between HIV and domestic violence. In the last set of slides, you saw that women who are often in relationships where domestic violence is prevalent are not making decisions, and their decision-making often, when women are in situations where they're living in domestic violence, they don't have control of when their partners come in, when they have sex. Sex is often forcible, and so we need to make sure that women are being empowered, and that happens through a very combined network. Thank you.
We heard from Charlotte about the level and extent of violence against sex workers. The next speaker is someone that I've had the fortune to have met at the Beijing Women's Conference many years ago, and who has continued to be an incredibly strong advocate for women's rights and sex workers' rights. Her name is Ana Luisa Grego, and she has been a sex worker activist for over a decade. She's based in Montreal, and she was formerly with an organization called Stella. She currently works with sex workers' rights advocacy networks, mostly based in Central and Eastern Europe and Central Asia, and she has been doing extensive research on sex workers' rights in Zambia, South Africa, Botswana, and Namibia. Ana Luisa.
Thank you, and thank you so much for including sex workers' issues and rights on this panel. As has been mentioned, communities of sex workers all over the world face extremely high levels of sexual and physical violence. However, I think it's incredibly important to stress that violence is not inherent to sex work, that belief has allowed complacency and sometimes complicity with laws and policies that criminalize our lives and our work, that foster and fuel violence against sex workers. A number of studies in India, Bangladesh, Cambodia, now in 12 countries in Eastern Europe and Central Asia, as well as in South Africa, have shown that sex workers face extremely high levels of physical and sexual violence from the state, from law enforcement officers, from prison guards, from military and paramilitary. Laws and policies that criminalize sex work, that encourage police raids and repression, be it in the name of quote-unquote rescuing sex workers, be it in the name of quote-unquote rehabilitation, be it in the name of fighting morality, fighting illegal immigration, or fighting HIV. Those raids not only are experienced by many sex workers as a form of violence, but directly contribute to violence. Recently, sex worker communities have come even more under attack as conservative governments such as the U.S. government have pushed very hard on UNAIDS to change what were previously very solid positions endorsing sex workers' rights and decriminalization, and sex workers' rights to have health and healthy and safe working conditions. The recent UNAIDS guidance note draft that came out was a really interesting example of that. It both confounded sex work and trafficking and encouraged putting more power into the hands of law enforcement. I'd like you to put yourselves in the shoes, often running shoes, because you'll be running away from the police, or possibly high heels, of one of the sex workers, for example, in Macedonia, where 14 out of 17 in the past year reported routine sexual violence from police. And now imagine that the UNAIDS policy is encouraging giving more power to those very same police officers to detain you. The impunity that such state violence allows encourages and allows more violence. The fact that sex workers do not have equal access to protection of the law, do not feel that they can report physical or sexual violence against them not only by police or military, but by other people, be they partners, clients, people on the street, hooligans, encourages and fosters more violence against sex workers. The criminalization of clients, as has recently been proposed by a number of conservative governments, including the US, has been shown also to push sex workers underground and in more isolated and unsafe areas. Our own mini experience of a crackdown on clients in Montreal in 2001 showed that the rates of violence reported by sex workers jumped 3 times, and the rates of violence with a deadly weapon jumped 5 times. Sadly, the criminalization of clients is being pushed under supposedly the rhetoric of protecting women's rights. How cruelly ironic. As we know, violence puts women, but not only women, trans women, and also male sex workers at direct risk of HIV. I'd like to add that there is very, very little research on sexual and physical violence against trans sex workers, trans women. Some small pieces of data are coming out that show that often they face, in certain countries and contexts, just as high levels of sexual and physical violence as women who are not trans. There's also a dearth of studies on violence against male sex workers. Violence poses a direct risk of HIV transmission, as we have seen, and as will be presented later in this conference in a report by ALSIS, a group that supports and is made up of sex workers and allies in the Congo. Not only that, as I mentioned earlier, state violence fuels general violence. General violence makes it much more difficult to enforce condom use, not only with clients, but also with partners. Police raids, such as the ones that we are seeing in Cambodia right now, that confound sex work and trafficking, where police run into brothels in the name of saving sex workers, round them up and force them into rehabilitation centers, where they have eloquently spoken at this conference about being raped and beaten, also often cut off HIV-positive sex workers' access to treatment. Being detained regularly for periods of 3 days, going up to 3 months, or in some places 6 months, often means ARV treatment interruption for sex workers. And yet we have seen and heard at this conference that treatment is one of the best forms of HIV prevention. And we know that to fight HIV, sex workers are not part of the problem, we are part of the solution. And that if you give us human rights and safe working conditions, not only will we protect ourselves, we will protect our clients. And as was shown by the DMS, the Sanagachi project in Calcutta, we can also impact HIV epidemics in our regions as a whole. So raids interrupt access to treatment, therefore cut off our ability to protect ourselves and our lovers and clients from HIV. Not only that, police raids often result in condom seizure, either to be used as proof or evidence of, quote-unquote, evidence of prostitution, or just strictly out of police harassment or hate or bigotry towards us. So condom seizure is used as proof of prostitution, we've heard, in the States, in Serbia, in Macedonia, in Namibia. I met a young trans sex worker who hid the condoms for 10 other sex workers in her boots, because when the police came, they would shake them down for all their condoms. And of course, you have to keep on working. You still have to make your money. You still have to keep on getting by. Violent raids also push sex workers to work in isolated and unsafe areas where we are hidden, where we are unable to protect each other and use the techniques and solidarity work that we've been doing, although it has never been recognized informally for years and years, to try and protect each other from violence and protect our health. When you're isolated and in a hidden area, it also means you're cut off from HIV support services. It means you're cut off from services that could help and support you with violence. Raids often are brothel evictions, which means that you lose your home and your children lose their home too. In Bangladesh in the 1990s, there were the Tanbazar brothel evictions that were done, interestingly enough, to some audiences, they were portrayed as quote-unquote rehabilitation raids to save and rescue sex workers. To other audiences, they were portrayed as raids to fight vice and morality. Isn't that the way? Those evictions ended up in many sex workers becoming homeless, and as a result, becoming street sex workers who didn't have homes and were thus much more exposed to HIV and to violence. And that was found in research by Carol Jenkins in the 90s. Violence also means that if the policeman, this is all coming from the report that's just come out from DRC Congo, the sex workers' working conditions deteriorated dramatically after incidences of being raped, kidnapped, and beaten by police, because the psychological torture of having to stand on the street corner and watch your aggressor walk by and threaten you and know that he has the legal right, even if detentions are done illegally, to arrest you and thus have power over you, is an incredible psychological weight to bear. And so many sex workers either left the city center and went to more remote areas, or they left the sort of downtown core. As a result, many of them subsequently had much difficulty accessing the health services they needed, either for HIV treatment or for treatment related healthcare related to the attacks they had just lived. In the study that the DRC will be presented, that the DRC's human ALSIS's human rights report on conditions in the DRC, of 63 cases of sexual violence against sex workers that they documented in 3 months, 29 were by police or military. Six of the women who reported attacks died subsequently from a lack of medical treatment following the attacks because they had left and gone back to remote areas where they would not be constantly in the presence of their aggressor. I just want to wrap up by saying we know what works for fighting HIV and violence against sex workers. It is not a mystery. It is changing laws that criminalize sex work. It is giving sex workers the support to self-organize and fight for better working conditions and organize to be able to support each other to enforce condom use. It is supporting policies that support our ability to enforce condom use. It is adequate access not just to male and female condoms, but also to water-based lubes, which not only make the job much more pleasant and fun, but also prevent breakage when people use Vaseline or oils because they have no lube. Unfortunately, money right now is not being poured into the types of projects that have been shown to radically decrease HIV prevalence among sex workers or radically decrease rates of violence. Money, because of a handful of powerful and hypocritical conservative few, is being poured into so-called, quote, rehabilitation projects that have so far not been proven to work and certainly have zero evidence base for fighting HIV. So while our communities are being terribly affected by HIV and violence, money is not being given to actually being able to fight HIV and violence. Money is being given into fighting prostitution. And although it seems so basic and so sad to have to repeat in 2008, sex work is work and people have the right to a livelihood. Fighting sex work has so far meant fighting sex workers. And our communities continue to bear the scars and monumental losses as a result. As sex worker advocate Cheryl Overs recently wrote, the attacks on sex worker communities only prove that silence still equals death. It is going to take the courage of a number of us to stand up for sex workers' rights in the face of that conservative tide. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ana Luis. I now have the pleasure of welcoming Claudia Garcia Moreno, who is a physician from Mexico working on public health at the World Health Organization and who has extensive experience working on reproductive health and research. She's the head of the research on violence against women, and she has been working on gender, HIV, and sexuality. And one thing that you should know about Claudia is that she was really the driving force of work on this multi-country study on violence against women that has helped so many of us understand better the impact of violence on women's lives and has helped us document and provide evidence on which we can base our advocacy. She will be speaking about effective responses to combating violence against women.
Thank you. Charlotte has already mentioned the linkages, the many different ways in which violence against women and HIV intersect and interact. In addition, and one of the reasons why we are here today is that many of the risk factors for intimate partner violence and sexual violence overlap with are the same as the risk factors for HIV. Issues around gender inequality, lack of institutional support and community sanctions, social norms that promote gender roles that discriminate against women, that perpetuate and condone different forms of violence, that link notions of masculinity to violence, all impact on both epidemics. Poverty, economic stress, unemployment, lack of property rights, lack of inheritance rights, impact again on both epidemics. Relationship characteristics, the types of relationships based on inequality, power imbalance and conflict, alcohol and substance misuse. Both epidemics affect young people. In the case of women, the risk of being a victim. In the case of men, also the risk of being a victim as well as a perpetrator. And again, Charlotte already mentioned how early violence, child sexual abuse, leaves scars and is a risk factor both in terms of perpetration, of victimization, as well as in terms of high-risk behaviors. It's important when we think of prevention to think of these risk factors and protective factors as well at all these different levels, the level of the individual, but also looking at those structural and societal issues, community, access to services in the community, access to support, so that we really develop prevention packages, as somebody was in the plenary talking about, combined prevention that really address issues at all these different levels. We have a very limited evidence base for what works in terms of preventing intimate partner violence and sexual violence. Few of the studies have, we have few evaluations. We have evaluations designs that often are weak. Many of the interventions have stayed at the level of small scale interventions. I think very few scale-up interventions, except with possibly the community awareness-raising campaigns, where we have seen a larger larger programs, but where the evaluation designs again stay at the level of changes in knowledge, and not necessarily looking at what the outcome in terms of behavior change are. Having said this, I think it's very noticeable and commendable, and for some of us who have attended other sessions on violence, to see that there is a growing body of evidence, and we have some very strong, well-documented interventions that are really bringing new perspectives into what we can do. Also, the evidence base as it exists has largely, until very recently, focused on developed countries. And while there's a lot of good things to learn, we also need to be cautious about simply transposing what we do in one setting to other settings. The prevention approaches to intimate partner violence and sexual violence and to HIV and violence include in those focused on promoting gender inequalities, changing social norms, particularly around violence and masculinity, issues around strengthening laws, policies, and institutional responses, issues around promoting healthy and equal relationships, structural interventions, And moving to more of the specifics, although there is really not a very good way of classifying, these are some of the programmatic responses where we have some promising interventions that have the potential to be replicated and scaled up. It's important also to emphasize that the life course approach is important. There are a lot of early childhood interventions, for example, around parenting programs, around home visiting, which have been proven to be effective in developed country settings, in higher income settings, but which pose difficulties in terms of how one could implement them in resource-poor settings. But where, again, there is the potential to explore how to deliver these. School-based interventions, particularly around safe dating, but if one thinks again of starting early in childhood around promoting responsible relationships, around promoting self-esteem, around promoting nonviolent ways of conflict resolution. Public information and awareness campaigns, community-based mobilization, and structural and policy approaches to improving criminal justice response, to strengthening women's rights, to changing, again, social norms in different ways. And lastly, and I put it there because it uses, in a way, some of the different forms mentioned above, but is a very specific and, I think, growing area where we have, again, growing evidence that there are things that work. Is a focus on working with men and boys to increase their responsibility and ownership of the issue and to challenge notions of masculinity that are linked to violence. Very briefly, just some examples of prevention intervention that have at least some evidence of effectiveness and which some of which we've heard about in other sessions. Stepping Stones in South Africa, which is focused on working with women and men on different kinds of raising issues around gender awareness, equitable relationships, communication, etc. Work with men and boys, which we'll hear about some more shortly, where again there is some evidence that interventions can lead to change in terms of notions and even behavior around violence, condom use. The image study, which we've heard about and which really is a very groundbreaking study looking at the link of microfinance with a gender and HIV curriculum, and Sister Act, which we heard about also yesterday, which looked at improving intergenerational communication around sexuality, risk behavior, and HIV and violence protection. All of these have, to some degree, been shown to have some impact on violence, intimate partner violence, and sexual violence, and all of them, in some ways, have the potential also to impact on HIV. And we need to really look at how we can build on this, evidence that we have, limited as it is, look at how we can scale up some of these interventions, and in the case of IMAGE, we are seeing what I think will be a very fascinating scale up in a big way, which will be really interesting to track, because it will be the first of its kind. And we need to also think of how can we link better our interventions for prevention of intimate partner and sexual violence in HIV programs. In spite of the fact that we have a growing number of sessions, and it's very exciting to see that in this conference, and that we are talking more about the linkages and the need to address them together, there is still really a large degree of separation. And we need to start at least with where we can bring the issue of violence into existing programs. There's a lot of scope in certainly linking it to education and awareness raising campaigns. We need to bring it to, for example, the training for testing counselors to be able to address issues around gender-based violence and disclosure. We need to link it when we're talking about fostering social norms for gender equality. And we need to support these dialogues that that Ebony has been working on in the United States, and that also we see more and more of in other countries, where we bring the communities working on violence, on HIV, on sexual and reproductive health. We have this tendency to fragment things, but unfortunately in our lives, or fortunately, everything links together. And the more that we can develop those links, I think the stronger we'll be able to respond to both epidemics. Thank you.
Thank you, Claudia. And you spoke of a key aspect of this work, which is working with men and boys. And we're fortunate to have with us this morning someone who has been working with men and boys and their engagement and support for gender equality for a very long time. Bafana Khumalo from South Africa is the co-founder and director of Sonke Gender Justice, whose work focuses primarily with men and boys on HIV and AIDS, gender, and human rights. He has served as the deputy chair and is now a part-time commissioner with the Commission on Gender Equality in South Africa. And when I first met Bafana, I asked him how and why he was engaged in this work with men and boys. And I was fascinated by his response, which was that we could not afford to let men off the hook. So I would like for you to help me welcome Bafana.
Good afternoon. In sub-Saharan Africa today, we're confronted by three pandemics: poverty, HIV/AIDS, and gender-based violence. Just over a year ago, we met as colleagues and decided what is it that we can do to make a difference and reduce the scourge of gender-based violence in our society. We conducted a survey with over 1,000 men, asking them three simple questions: what their response is to gender-based violence. Secondly, what is the government response and how they feel about that response? And thirdly, how would they intervene in reducing this scourge? The responses were varied but very interesting in many respects. On the first question, most men reacted with anger, acknowledged that gender-based violence is indeed a major problem in our society, and that they did not support it, and that it's something that needs to be uprooted from the roots so that indeed all of the people in our society can have lives free of gender-based violence. But what was very interesting for us is the response to the second question. Most of the men polled for this survey responded that government was doing too much. Of course, because in South Africa we have a legislative framework that seeks to respond to these gender challenges with our Domestic Violence Act, the new Sexual Offences Act, the Maintenance Act, and a myriad of other laws that are progressive. Indeed, men do feel like government is doing too much. But the third response to us raised even more fundamental questions around involving men in the whole notion of gender equality. The men responded, yes, we are keen to intervene, but often we don't know what to do. We are at a loss. If I know that my friend is abusing his partner or spouse, what is it that I can do? More often than not, if I do get involved, I become part of the problem because I then get accused that I have a relationship with his partner, and therefore that's why I'm intervening. This gave rise to what we developed as the One Man Can campaign, which is a campaign that seeks to involve men, because indeed from this survey it was clear that men do want to change. Men do want to engage in positive interventions that will reduce the scourge of violence in our society, but they lack skills of how to do it. If you've grown up in an environment where virtually everything in society has told you it is correct to do certain things in a particular way, it is not easy to take a different view. And so we developed this intervention as a way of mobilizing men so that indeed young men and boys and older men can play a positive role in reducing the scourge of gender-based violence in our society. We targeted influential role players in society. We do work with traditional leaders, because in many instances when you talk to men about why they do these things, part of the excuse people give is about culture, that it is my culture that I should do this. And I always argue back that I'm not an anthropologist, but the little bit that I have done on all cultures that I'm aware of in Africa, none actually says it is the man's right to abuse their spouse. There can be no justification whatsoever to justify the kind of treatment that women get in our society on the basis of culture. On the contrary, what I have found is that cultures actually place a lot of burden on men to protect and provide for their families. That has its own problems, but the point I'm wanting to make is how culture is often misused in order to justify something that should not be justified. We work with religious leaders in our society because, once more, religion also plays a very influential role in ensuring that the status quo obtains. In most of our religious groupings, very little positive intervention is given to the situation of gender-based violence. It's either condoned subtly or given a mystical definition, like it's the devil that's making men behave this way. Let's pray about it. It will go away. Partly because majority of people in our religious sectors who are leaders, who are the ones who are driving efforts in these institutions, are men. Possibly they themselves do these things in their own homes and therefore find nothing wrong with this kind of behavior. We work with boys on gender awareness and health wellness because we also think this is very important. Most men thrive on what I call dangerous masculinities. Masculinities that expose us men to all sorts of vulnerabilities. Having more girlfriends is seen as being very hip and chic, and therefore, in order to prove your manhood, you have as many sexual encounters as you can, with all the attendant exposures that are related to this kind of behavior. But as I said, men indeed do want to change. And before Zoni says to me, I must stop, I just want to give you two quick examples. We work with an organization, I'm glad my colleagues are here, from Woodspruit in Limpopo. When we started work there a few years ago, it was a very difficult terrain for us to go and work in a farming community, to work with farm laborers who, many of them come from rural settings of our country, very conservative, have a view that culture is rigid and certain things have to be done in particular ways. And we decided to start in our work in that area with the supervisors who were very influential in the farming area because they had the right to appoint who gets a job and had the right to allocate accommodation in the compounds. And so there were lots of issues of transactional sex, abuse, abuse of alcohol, and as my colleagues have indicated, the related abuses that go with this kind of behavior. In doing this work with the group of supervisors, we had an old man of over 60. Every morning when we start our sessions, we start with a reflection of what we did the previous day. And as we learn from Paulo Freire, that when you work with adults, it's always important to get them involved in their own learning so that they take responsibility for their transformation. And so this old man, on a Wednesday morning, we had started on Monday, raised his hand and said, no, I want to share something with you. And I said, oh, now we're going to have trouble, because I expected he was one of the most conservative in the group. He's probably going to tell us to pack up and leave. But what he said was, I went home yesterday, which was on a Tuesday evening. He said, I called all my children and my wife, and I laid down the law. I told them from today, we're not going to wait for their mother to come back from work, because she knocks off later than all of us, to prepare dinner for us, to clean the house, and do the washing. He said, I told my sons, he only has sons, he doesn't have a daughter, that from today, things are going to change in the house. All of us are going to pitch in. We're all going to help with whatever we can. But he said, don't expect me to cook. I'm too old to learn, but I will wash the dishes. And that was a very significant transformation for me, that this man has come to this level and has not only ingested these ideas, but have begun to enact them in his own life. The second example is one of a chief in KwaZulu-Natal, very progressive young man whose land was taken away from the community during the times of land acquisition by the apartheid regime. He got married to one lady, to cut the story short, and she was a development-orientated person who worked very hard to help the community reclaim their land. They reclaimed the land. She started projects in the community, and the community was involved, food gardening and all sorts of very creative things. When things were much more stable, the community came to the chief and said, well, this wife that you married yourself. She's not the one that we choose for you as the community. So we are going to choose one for you as it is custom, so that you marry the one who will give birth to the next king for this tribe. And he refused. He said, I can't do that. How can I turn back on a woman who has been with me even when I was going through very difficult situations? How do I then now play this big chief who must get so many wives simply because the community says that is the way the culture has to do it? And they engaged in serious confrontations, almost threatening to dethrone him. And he came to the Gender Commission to lay a claim. Now, I find it very interesting that for those of you who know anything about KwaZulu-Natal in South Africa, you would know that it's one of the most conservative areas. To have a chief having to take that stand against his community, and not only stop there, but to approach a constitutional institution to lay a claim against his own community, is a positive sign that indeed men can change, and we have a lot of work to do. Thank you.
Thank you, Bafana. Our last speaker is Patience Mandishona from Zimbabwe, who courageously works for gays and lesbians of Zimbabwe. She's a lesbian activist that has been involved with women's work and also the HIV and AIDS movement. And she is here as part of a delegation of groups working with Just Associates. Patience.
Okay. Good afternoon. I would like to maybe share with you the situation in Zimbabwe, where I come from. As an activist coming from Zimbabwe, I see a lot of women and I work with a lot of women. And recently we've been going through a political situation, which I think most of you are aware of. And I've seen and talked to so many women who experienced violence due to the political situation. And the sad thing is most of these cases were not documented at all. Most of the women are actually living in fear, and they would not want to talk about the forms of violence that they went through because of the presence maybe of the army and the police within the areas that they stay in. My work revolves around working with lesbians, bisexual, and transgendered women. And as recently within Southern Africa, we've experienced a lot of hate crimes, especially in South Africa. And slowly it's starting to come into Zimbabwe. We have lesbian women being attacked, raped, beaten up, murdered because of their sexuality. And there are no policies at all that protect these women within our country. And mainly this is fueled by the criminalization of same-sex relationships. Many people who work within the HIV and AIDS field do not realize the impact of the hate crimes, the impact that it has on HIV and the exposure that women have to HIV due to these crimes. Recently in Zimbabwe, we were celebrating our new domestic violence law. And the sad thing is there is no documentation at all on who has been protected by this law, especially for the lesbian and bisexual women that I work with. And within the law itself, the women are not even acknowledged. It's something that we have challenged the policymakers, but it was not taken up as an issue. And so the domestic violence law within our country does not even protect lesbian and bisexual women. So I maybe just urge people within the HIV and AIDS movement to maybe look at issues of the LGBT women and put them on their agendas. The violence, protective barriers, and all those issues, and maybe try and look at it from a different point of view. Thank you.
Is this on? Okay. Hello? Yes, it's on. We would like to just, we had prepared some questions, but it's now that we wanted to ask of each other here on the panel, but I think since we only have about another half an hour for our discussion, we would like to then invite you all, if you have questions, comments, or suggestions, to come up to, we have two mics here on each side, but there are also a couple of people walking in the hallway with cards if you would prefer to submit your cards. And there's some cards at the back if someone, Christina, could you help us pick up the cards, please, just on this side. So if I can ask you to keep your questions or comments to be brief so that we can have a discussion. Thank you. Yes.
Thank you. I'm Lynn Lucy, working in the Democratic Republic of Congo. I have a question for the panel and also a contribution to our brother here. Firstly, none of you made any reference at all to prosecution as a protection. There's laws exist. Is this your experience, as it also is in Democratic Republic of Congo, that prosecutions of offenses against women are just useless? And second comment I have for the experience of men in South Africa, our experience also in Congo is that we have a law, a new law from 2006 that defines sexual violence really widely, and the community isn't informed about the law, doesn't appreciate the importance of it. But here we found an amazing response amongst the spiritual leaders, amongst the Christians and Muslim leaders, and going to them with the law, but also at the same time, verses from the Quran, verses from the Bible, and also traditional proverbs. It's been very effective in changing the mentality of the men and getting them involved in community action. Thank you.
Thank you. We'll take a couple more questions, and then I will read one of the questions from the cards. So please go ahead. Can you say your name and where you're from as well?
Yes. My name is Denise Parmentier from Oxfam in the Netherlands. I think you have mentioned a lot of programs that are working, but I think what this big challenge is, how do you scale up? And I want to make an appeal to a lot of the donor communities. They don't know the answer. They're asking all the NGOs, how do we scale up? And I think it's not a matter of money. I think it is of a good intervention. In the 25 years that I've been working in this field, I have only seen one very promising practice which is scaling up, which is called the Girl Child Network Movement in Zimbabwe, which is really a rural movement. And in each household in Zimbabwe, they know what it is. Girls are member of it, the mothers want to be member, the fathers want to be member, and it uses confrontational techniques. I think you have to use it. They are very simple. It says them that as a girl or a woman, you have a right of 1 meter to decide if a man comes near to you. You can use simple techniques like drawing from the community, looking at a man. It can be like a preacher, a teacher, a grandfather, a husband, and then look for a girl or a woman and say, can you imagine this man violating this girl? Can you violating this woman? You can't believe the impact it has. So I would like to see that we have to invest much more in movements and not in small-scale things, but in good and very confronting tactics.
Thank you. I'll just take a question from this side as well.
Thank you. My name is Emily Bancroft. I'm with Physicians for Human Rights. And we work with health professionals as part of our Health Action AIDS campaign in Uganda, Kenya, and Rwanda, educating and mobilizing them to become advocates for health and human rights issues in their countries. And there were a few references to sort of bringing together a more comprehensive approach to addressing violence against women or gender-based violence in this panel. And I'm just wondering about the role that you all see health professionals potentially playing in the response to gender-based violence. You know, many of them interact with women who have been impacted but don't quite know what to do. So what's the role of health professionals in advocacy and in education and in helping to address some of these issues around gender-based violence? Thank you.
Thank you. And one question from the floor on the cards from Barry Hall with the International Community of Women Living with HIV. It's more of a comment. We at ICW consider forced sterilization and abortion as a form of violence against us, women living with HIV. I don't think I heard it mentioned. And she notes that ICW is engaged in documented cases of forced sterilization and abortion in South Africa and Namibia. So I would just ask the panel as they would like to respond to some of the questions.
I can take a couple of questions. Certainly, I agree with the fact that we need to scale up. And I think that in the plenary yesterday, there were reference to two gaps, which I think are very relevant to this area. One is the research gap. There is very little funding going into research to see what works and how can we scale it up. And the only way we will be able to scale up is you know, first knowing that whatever we're going to scale up does work, and most donors want to know that. So we need to be able to support this research and then to look at what are the mechanisms that allow us to scale up. And as I mentioned, I think we have an interesting work going on in South Africa that will be very, very relevant to this discussion. Certainly that's the challenge. We need to learn from what we know, do more and learn more, and then scale it up. I think in terms of the role of health professionals, we focus very much on what in public health we call primary prevention, stopping the problem from happening in the first place. And certainly I think physicians and other health providers as leaders in their communities and as role models and have a very strong role to play in advocacy. And I think the health argument, the impact on the health and lives of women is a very strong advocacy tool. They also have a very important role to play in identifying women suffering from violence and its consequences as early as possible and stopping further harm. And we obviously, from the WHO perspective, focus a lot on working with health professionals in building skills around responding better to intimate partner and sexual violence. I want to say something about the issue of legal reform and strengthening criminal justice, because there has been quite a strong focus on that. And again, I think the how much it impacts on actually stopping violence is not really well understood, but it certainly sends a strong message about around the issue of what is acceptable. And there is it's an enormous field in and of itself. How to improve, and it certainly forms a part of the multi-sectoral response. I think one of the things that we didn't say, but it's obviously important, is that we, you know, it's not one intervention or one program that is going to solve this issue. It is an issue that requires interventions at all levels and from all sectors, and that is also a challenge in terms of scaling up to build the mechanisms that allow for coordinated and responses where the different sectors are strengthening each other. And criminal justice is clearly an important one.
I just want to add on some of the questions. In terms of the issue of scale up, it's the $1 million question. We've just did a small intervention empowering women with microfinance and participatory training and showed that we halve the levels of violence in the community in rural South Africa. We're scaling up by the end of 2010 where we hope to reach 15,000 women. But, you know, how can we go further? And I think when we've been thinking about how do we scale up, increasingly we're recognizing, well, actually, the model that we implemented on a small scale gives us insights about what might be the broader structural change that we need to advocate for at a national level. So in the particular intervention, we were using microfinance plus participatory training on gender. So the broader sort of national policy is really around, you know, economic opportunities for women, addressing some of those gender inequalities, not only with microfinance, but a whole range of other forms of economic opportunity, plus trying to add to that very strong actions and messaging around gender, HIV, and violence. And so I think the danger when donors look at a successful model that is often implemented by an NGO on a small scale, they say, well, how do we scale up? They just think they're going to do the same thing on a huge scale. And I think we need to be a bit more subtle about the way that we learn lessons and think, well, actually, what were the key elements of that and what might be the structures that we need to change to try and enact that on a much larger scale? And then the other point was the question from ICW, and I really feel bad that I didn't include that in my presentation, because clearly forced sterilization and abortion is a form of violence against HIV-positive women.
In response...
Or any woman.
In response to the question from ICW, this also becomes, again, an issue of increasing sexual and reproductive health rights. In honoring GPA, that people who are living with HIV do still have a right to sexual health, do have a right to autonomy. Just as we want to have a combination approach around cocktails and drug treatment, there also has to be a combination approach around prevention that includes healthy sexual and reproductive health messages, legislation, and policy. And it also speaks to what someone asked about the inclusion of healthcare providers. When a woman tests HIV positive, that is the first level of isolation. That's the first level of loss. You don't get that moment back again to not become positive. And so you need affirmation that comes also in your legislation, but also from your healthcare provider, that there's a partnership, that you can talk about being a sexual being, and that you can talk about the relationship and dynamics that happen with there. As that relationship is developed, as that there is rapport, you can talk about the culminating factors like domestic violence, but there has to be a ground that happens. We need to make sure that our healthcare providers are not only able to treat HIV as it manifests metabolically, as it manifests medically, but also that it manifests on an emotional scale. Oftentimes, women are in isolation. Their HIV provider may be the only person that they have, or even their primary care doctor that's going to help them to make that linkage. We need to also not be territorial. We need to look to our community partners. There's not just one way of doing it. There's not just one model. It's going to take a lot of things. It's going to take social marketing. That first of all, we've had 25 years of stigma around HIV. And so when women become infected, or when we even discuss testing, it's something that has been vilified, it's been made dirty, it's been made bad. It's only something that happens to a certain kind of people who have been living a certain kind of risque lifestyle. So as we get those layers eliminated, then we can ask people to get tested and people to feel engaged, people to feel safe. And the messages can't just be about women. They have to be inclusive of men. It is a full circle across the spectrum. You know, and it's particularly sad in the U.S. We have a place where HIV rates, we have just got a report saying that they have been underreported, and still we have a curriculum that's abstinence-based. We are not speaking to the needs of what is tangibly happening. And so that needs to be reflected. How can we reduce violence when we haven't been able to get people to say the word and for there to be humanity there? HIV is happening, and so we have to make it that HIV is treatable. If you don't have it, we don't want you to get it. But also, if you do have it, that you can live. We're asking men to not be violent, and we're asking them to do something that they haven't been trained to do. As we are integrating sexual and reproductive health in the schools early on, not waiting to the onset, not waiting until someone is coming home and it looks like issues of cheating. So now you've got women who have gone out, gotten power, gotten information, and they come home and saying, let's use a condom. Well, I haven't been taught about condom use. Everything I know about condom use is related to cheating. So it's going to be a very integrated approach where we're saying the same messages at every level, in the homes, in the schools, with the healthcare providers, that we're not vilifying and making sex dirty, and that we're making it where people have ownership of their sexual rights, ownership of their responsibility, and where women will not be in positions where domestic violence is acceptable because they are champions for themselves.
Okay, we have a lot of questions and not a lot of time, so if I could ask you to keep your questions or comments very brief so that we can have as many people speak, that would be great.
Zani, can I quickly add just something towards for the last question?
Yes, thank you.
Sorry to put that sound. I just wanted to quickly add, in terms of the question around health professionals, one of the things that, thank you, ICW brought into my mind that I did not think about was coercion by health professionals is often a form of violence. And sex workers in many parts of the world, in many parts of Latin America and Kyrgyzstan and Latvia, deal with forced HIV and STI testing in conditions they do not control and with no confidentiality. And that should be a thing that health professionals can rally and unite around opposing and absolutely opposing participating in any way, shape, or form. I just also wanted to quickly respond to the question about prosecutions. Prosecutions, I do think, can send a strong message and make an important precedent. The problem that we are having, again, is that with sex workers, when the state is part of violence, it's very difficult to report violence and be taken seriously. There have been really important things that have been done to strengthen the ability to report violence. Some of those are like anti-discrimination laws. In Brazil, there's a law that's being put forward against discrimination against sex workers. It's changing policy in Canada. The Victims Compensation Board, run by the state, refused to give compensation to a friend and colleague who was stabbed 17 times. Because they said it was her fault because she was a sex worker. On appeal, they said it actually wasn't her fault because she was a sex worker. It was her fault because she was an unrepentant and old sex worker and should have known better by then. Luckily, she appealed and won. And I think that being able to shift policy in terms of the way the state responds to violence is what will open the door to actually being able to use some mechanisms to stop violence. In Brazil, again, the government, in collaboration with sex workers, had a whole rights, health and rights campaign that was called you're a professional, you can denounce violence that was targeted at sex workers, so it helped to fight the stigma associated with being a sex worker and open the doors to being able to report violence. And finally, I wanted to say, again, state violence is an issue, and prosecution is not the easiest way to go about changing state violence. It's changing the laws and the policies, and I think that that's something that is also has to always be part of it.
Thank you. Your question, please.
Hello. My name is Barbara Rijks. I work for the International Organization for Migration, based in South Africa, working in Southern Africa. Our organization is working quite a bit with victims of human trafficking, and I was just wondering, maybe a question to Ana Louise, what would be your position or your ideas about decriminalization versus legalization of sex work? I come from Holland myself, and I have understood that since the Dutch government, they, for a long time, they have decriminalized sex work, but now they've actually legalized it, and that actually made undocumented migrants, especially from Eastern Europe, go more underground and actually more vulnerable than at the time when it was decriminalized. So maybe just your point on that. And I just want to applaud the patients from Zimbabwe for doing brave work. And I think for... Thank you.
I am Phyllis Kachere. I write for the Sunday Mail in Zimbabwe. My question is for the panel. I would like to know if there's been any research or things like that on the relationship between HIV and rape, particularly in conflict areas, especially in sub-Saharan Africa, it being the epicenter of the epidemic. Maybe if you could comment on that.
Okay, thank you. We'll take a few more questions and then we'll come back to the panelists. Please.
I'm Catherine Button. I'm a psychologist from the NHS in London. And it actually picks up on the last question as well, that I've been to quite a few talks in this conference where women have raised issues of gender violence and it's often been dropped by the panel when they're answering. Or yesterday, I went to an evening session about Zimbabwe and I raised the issue of gender violence as a context. And again, was told that apparently the latest issue of the Journal of Epistemology says that rape has no bearing on HIV rates. So how do we work with our colleagues if we're thinking about different levels of intervention? What do you do with things like that?
Yes, please.
My name is Jerry Lavallee. I'm from Canada, based out of Toronto. I'm with the Canadian Union of Public Employees. And my question is specifically for Ana Louise, although if anyone else on the panel wants to respond, that's more than welcomed. We're currently working or trying to work on a campaign on the decriminalization of sex work in Canada. And we initially started with wanting to, you know, legalize sex work in Canada, and there was so much opposition, it was unreal. So we fell back to the decriminalization of sex work in Canada, and I'm finding that there's so much opposition, even within our own ranks. I work in equity-seeking groups within our union. And so what I would like to know is what your... I believe you said you were out of Montreal. If you would be willing to come and talk to us,
sure.
Honestly, and really sort of vocalize what you just said today, you know, and just go from committee to committee to committee. We meet all at once every once in a while. That would be a great help to me because we're kind of, it's like banging our head against the wall, trying to make the point that sex work is real work. It's, and there's some really serious equality issues there and some infringements on human rights and so on. And so we really would like to get that going. If there's a way that I can contact you somehow, would be much appreciated. But thank you.
Thank you. That meeting of the two of you could be a very concrete outcome of this session, so this is great. I have two questions that I think relate to each other. So the first one is, how can we shift gender norms and masculinities to end violence against women, particularly when it is the men who hold the power to make change happen within all institutions, from the family through government and legal institutions? And the second one is related, and it comes from a Mexican colleague, and she asks, si la violencia de las mujeres a las mujeres la provoca el sistema patriarcal machista, no es entonces la mente de los hombres la que hay que cambiar primero. If the violence against women is caused by the patriarchal system that is also machista,
No, isn't it important that we change the mind of men first?
Can we start with you, Bafana?
I think that's precisely the reason why we are doing the work we are doing with men, because we think precisely for that reason we do need to deal with men on issues of patriarchy and what I call risky masculinities. Our view is that unless you do that, in our context, working with women, for instance, on gender-based violence, whilst it's important and needs to be done, in some instances exposes women to even more violence. Because women who come home having acquired all this knowledge about their rights and want to assert that in a condition where they are living with an abusive spouse, that in itself sparks new violence. And we think we need to make an intervention as men and speak to other men around these issues and bring more men on board so that indeed we change this approach of what it means to be a man. That it's not just about being aggressive, it's not just about exposing these risky masculinities. It's also about accepting that as men we are vulnerable, that we don't have to prove our manhood by being violent, that it does not make us less of men if we actually treat other human beings as full human beings. And that work is important with men and also with boys, so that we transform this kind of thinking.
Others from the panel would like to respond to some of the questions. Yes, Annelise.
Your question. I wanted to first of all say I think we're all clear that trafficking is a major labor abuse and human rights abuse across all industries. And I think it's really important to not pit sex workers' rights against efforts to stop trafficking. I think that sex workers are not only against trafficking, but often the best placed in efforts to stop trafficking. So this was seen in the Sanagachi project in the Red Light District in Calcutta, where sex workers put together self-regulatory boards with sex workers working in the brothels, along with different human rights advocates and sensitive medical personnel, with the understanding that sex workers working in the brothels will probably be the first to encounter someone who's either a minor or who's coerced into the sex trade and needs help, and that help should be given on their own terms from a human rights framework, not by forcing them into prison, not by deporting them, not by forcing them into a rehabilitation center. I think that in terms of the claims that in Holland trafficking has increased, those are disputed by many. They're also disputed by many people who see decriminalization as one of the best ways to stop trafficking. As long as sex work is criminalized, many people argue that it's much more difficult for sex workers to denounce human rights abuse, coercion, trafficking. There are groups like the Foundation Against Trafficking in Holland who take that position, groups like the Global Alliance Against Trafficking in Women who take the position that sex workers' rights is a way to fight trafficking. In fact, the Asia-Pacific Network of Sex Work Projects has a big banner here, this work that says, decriminalize sex work to stop trafficking. I also think that it's important to question where certain claims are coming from. A lot of the claims that trafficking has increased in Holland come from groups who expressly oppose sex work and often confound sex work with trafficking, or often confound migrant sex work with trafficking. Sometimes they have not only an anti-sex work agenda, but also an anti-migration agenda. That said, I think it's absolutely true that the rights of migrant sex workers and also other migrant workers, migrant domestic workers, migrant restaurant workers, are not protected in Holland. And I think that's the case in many of our countries. So I absolutely believe that there needs to be both law and policy reform that centers around protecting the rights of migrant workers. And I do think that sex workers' rights are not in opposition to trafficking again, but are one of the best ways to achieve an end to trafficking.
Thank you. Are there other responses to the questions from the panel?
Can I just ask that if people are interested, in the interest of time, that you can go to differentavenues.org. We just put out a document on sex worker rights and domestic violence. In Washington, D.C., with a lot of the new policies and legislations, sex workers are overly targeted for violence, in just inhumane things in response to their acts to exchange sex, and they're being forcibly beaten instead of going to jail. A lot of transgender persons are particularly targeted. Oftentimes, there is not other work for transgender persons. And so we have to just really change the legislation. We have to hold systems accountable. And people say they don't want to legalize sex work because it is bad for the community. They don't want to legalize it because it's bad for their values.
Thank you. We have it's now 12:30. We have but very, very briefly, we can still, we've been given 5 minutes of grace, so we can wrap up a little bit and take a couple more questions.
I just wanted to respond to the issue about research showing the linkages between sexual violence and HIV and the article that has been referred to. I think it's important to distinguish between the relationship between violence and HIV at a population-based prevalence level and issues around individual risk for women, and the issues of how it's not just, as Charlotte mentioned, that there's a potential for a direct transmission. Obviously, if you are raped by an HIV-negative person, then there is a zero risk of transmission. So the risk is related to the overall prevalence of HIV. But the context of violence generates a setting for women where many other vulnerabilities and risks are increased. There's also the issue of how violence and living in a climate of violence, especially at the domestic level, impacts women's ability to access prevention, treatment, and care. And finally, and I think the recent article, different to previous articles by the same author, does recognize that both problems are major public health problems that need to be addressed. And I think while we are here in an HIV/AIDS conference emphasizing the links and the intersections of HIV and violence, we definitely need to be very clear that violence needs to be addressed in its own right, as well as because of its impact on specific health outcomes.
Just to add to that, I mean, the paper that has led to these sorts of statements that, well, you know, rape isn't driving the epidemic, so we didn't need to bother, are very concerning. And to think through that issue a bit more, myself and colleagues have done some modeling to look at how an individual woman's risk of HIV might be affected by different scenarios around rape, drawing on what we know is happening in many conflict and post-conflict settings. And there's a poster up today by Anna Foss that presents those results, so I'd encourage you to look at those.
We have maybe 15 seconds per question, so Cynthia.
Okay. First, great panel. Second, patients, I also would like to thank you for your courage and for the great work of GALS and the other organizations with which you're working. I also want to take your challenge, and I would have posed this question to the panelists to respond to in terms of lesbian invisibility generally. My name is Cynthia Rothschild. I work with an organization called the Center for Women's Global Leadership. One of the things that is fairly clear is that while in one sense all women are targeted for violence, it's also true that women in marginalized groups are explicitly targeted for violence, and that lesbians are often we're not part of the rhetoric that rises to the top in these conversations. There is a session at 1:30 today that will further the discussion about lesbians and HIV, and I'll close simply by saying that we're in a complicated situation in which there's a level of impunity for acts of violence targeted against lesbians because lesbians don't feel comfort in reporting generally. And I would call upon panelists, possibly not now, to figure out ways of addressing same-sex sexuality, even if to say we don't have the statistics and we don't have the evidence because of these political challenges. It would be very useful for our advocacy. Thank you.
Thank you. I positive woman. Mi nombre es Lisette Herrera. I speak Spanish. Soy de la YWCA de Perú. Mi preocupación, mi inquietud es que en Perú hay mucha violencia psicológica contra las mujeres que vivimos con el VIH y nuestra gran dificultad es que no podemos comprobar, no podemos denunciarla y no hay leyes efectivas contra esto. Recibimos maltrato de nuestras parejas, de nuestros esposos. Cuando buscamos ayuda en la iglesia nos dicen, es tu esposo. Y cuando buscamos ayuda en las otras personas nos dicen, es tu pareja, está cansado, qué sé yo. Queremos experiencias de ustedes en tema de violencia psicológica contra las mujeres.
Okay, I will try my best to translate. Lisette is from the YWCA in Peru. She's a woman living with HIV. And her concern is that in Peru, there's a great deal of violence against women living with HIV, psychological violence. And when they seek help, they are told it's your partner, it's your spouse, either from institutions or from the church. And so she is asking the panelists if they have any experiences to share on responses to psychological abuse of women living with HIV. I hope I got it correctly.
My name is Portia. I'm from South Africa. I'm a TAC member. Mine is not actually a question, but it's just an addition. I'd love to thank patient of what he has said. It is true, patients, that hate crime has a high prevalence in South Africa. Girls who are lesbian are brutally murdered and raped for nothing because of their sexuality. And the justice system is doing nothing unto that. And unless we act and come with a strategy to end that, it will never end. If a woman is raped and if a lesbian is raped, those are two different charges. Because a lesbian has been raped because of her sexuality, because it's a rape that is caused by hate. So the conviction must be of a high charge. And the other thing is, we keep on talking about campaigning, educating, making awarenesses and all, but the justice system is failing us at all times. We report these cases, but at the end of the day, they don't end up in conviction. So our work at the end of the day is useless, but we need to fight our justice system, and we need they are reported these cases. We get their stats all the time, but we don't know how many cases end up in conviction. And the other thing is that,
sorry,
if a woman...
Sorry, I'm sorry. Can I... Okay, I thank you very much for your statement. It's extremely important, but I've been told that the next session starts at 12:45, and I apologize to the people that are waiting to ask their questions. And I would invite you to come and speak and ask your questions from the speakers. We will be around for a few minutes longer. But just before we wrap up, just two words from each one of the speakers, starting with Ebony, if there's something very brief that you'd like to say as a way forward.
We have to address HIV and domestic violence. It's a strong intersection. In communities of poverty and communities where people are already facing isolation, we have to make sure that the laws are in place to protect them. Patient advocacy, healthcare advocacy, and strong sexual and reproductive health rights. Again, please refer to JEEPA. Please refer to the United Nations campaign. We have to do better by people.
I'd like to thank everyone for the support, for the work that we're doing, and just urge everyone to continue working and recognize LGBT issues within the work that you're doing, because I feel that coming from a place where LGBTI issues are not considered human rights issues, I would really urge everyone to just look at it differently. Thank you.
I would just say that there is a lot of scope and we need to really push for the integrating of violence issues into all other programs where it's relevant.
Yes, I would agree with colleagues that indeed we need to strengthen our legal framework But from South Africa, we have learned that the laws by themselves do not necessarily change the situation. We need to remain vigilant as civil society so that we hold our governments accountable for those laws in ensuring that they are implemented and implemented correctly.
I mean, in terms of what we can do, I mean, we're all here working in many different fields and areas, but I think the main message I'd want you to go away with is that whatever area that you're working on, violence is there, impacting on what you're doing, and you really need to look at it. It might be hidden, but it's there, and you need to think about how programmatically you can address that. Thanks.
Thank you. Thank you very much to our panelists. Thank you for being here, for listening, for joining in the conversation, and we look forward to continuing this dialogue on this very important issue. Thank you very much.